Yeah, thanks for coming to this talk. I know it's early, but good evening. So it's a bit late for me, but good evening. So today I'm going to be telling you about what primordial black holes are doing in the early universe. So this is some work I've been doing, and that's been in these two papers, one with Yassine Ali-Hammoud and another with Pascal Serpico, Vivian Poulin, and Kaz Khoury. And so I'll just sort of dive right in with some results that are sort of shown here. So we're interested in studying primordial black holes. And what my talk's gonna be about is largely simulating what they're doing in the early universe. And here's some results. So essentially what happens is that primordial black holes cause the universe to look very different if they're the dominant form of the dark matter. And so you can sort of see this in these slides where this top left panel is showing, you know, a case where primordial black holes make up only a very little amount of the dark matter. And so there's just one primordial black hole that you see down here, and everything else looks normal. But I should mention, this is normal for the early universe. So this density slice is at redshift 100, and it's also very small scales. So this volume is around 30 kiloparsecs, or the length scale is 30 kiloparsecs. And then we can sort of start to increase the amount of how much of the dark matter is made up of primordial black holes. So, you know, this panel here is showing 100, assimilate 100 times more primordial black holes. The next one down is showing 100 times more than that. So, and then the last one is showing, well, what if the dark matter is all primordial black holes? And you can see everything looks very different. So you go from this picture where at redshift 100, the universe looks more or less linear, to a situation where the universe does not look linear at all, and you have all these halos, all these structures. And so today what I'm going to be talking about is how this structure formation can start to affect, you know, how we put constraints on primordial black holes. Okay, so that's the overview. Again, this is some results, but let me walk it back and sort of talk about motivation to get us started. Okay, so why might we consider primordial black holes? And in specific, why might we consider solar mass primordial black holes, which will be what I focus on in this talk. Solar mass are heavier, I should say. And the reason, of course, is that they can solve some sort of big picture, large scale problems. So as I mentioned, primordial black holes could be a component or maybe the entirety of dark matter, because they're a type of cold dark matter. So what makes up the dark matter could be primordial black holes. And then they could also be responsible for some of the gravitational wave signals we've seen. So LIGO detected mergers of black holes. Well, maybe those black holes were primordial in origin. Okay, so let's discuss these in a bit more. Let's discuss both of these in a bit more detail. So first of all, primordial black holes being cold dark matter, that's just, okay. They're just a type of cold dark matter. They're cold and they're dark. They don't interact with light very much. But I want to put this slide in order to say, well, where do primordial black hole dark matter, where does it start to look different from other forms of dark matter? So this is what this surf cartoon plot is sort of showing. So in it, I'm showing the ratio of power spectrum. So the ratio of a power spectrum made up of some type of dark matter compared to the power spectrum of a regular lambda CDM sort of style WIMP type dark matter, if you like. So just what you expect. And so if this ratio is below one, that means that, essentially it means that the universe is looking less clustered than it would be in standard lambda CDM. So what does that mean? That means that the structures that form are smaller in size. So there's less heavy halos, if you like. But of course we can't just do arbitrary things because of course we have observations. So on large enough scales from our galaxy surveys, we know that dark matter looks cold, right? No problem for primordial black holes, is a problem for other types of models. But yeah, so everything on large enough scales has to look like cold dark matter. Then there's the fact that some amount of the dark matter is actually hot, or at least we have strong suspicions that some amount of the dark matter is hot in the form of the cosmic neutrino background. So we expect there's some amount of neutrinos. They're moving very fast. They're like a component of hot dark matter. And they make up a little bit and they cause, you know, a bit less structure in the universe to form. But again, they can't make up all the dark matter. on even smaller scales, people like to talk about warm dark matter or fuzzy dark matter, and these are sort of popular in order to solve some perceived like small scale problems in the Lambda CDM model. So essentially, these are postulated because you want to have a few less satellites to form or things like that. And so again, this is small scale, but when I'm talking about small scale structure in this talk, it's actually going to be much, much smaller scales than this. Because if you want to distinguish primary black holes from just other types of cold dark matter, well, when can you start distinguishing it? Well, you can start to distinguish it when you can notice the fact that primary black holes are not a continuum, or are not continuous. So you start noticing the fact that primary black holes are sort of discrete macroscopic objects. Okay. So that starts happening on very small scales. And because of this fact that primary black holes, if they're dark matter, they're these discrete objects, it turns out they will have slightly more power than it, or they'll have more power than in Lambda CDM. So this ratio goes above one, you see more things more clustered on these very small scales. And of course, we have constraints on things from power spectrum. So where this, where the power spectrum is incompatible with our observations tells us something about primordial black holes, or constrains their mass to be sort of less than around, 10 to the 4, a few times 10 to the 4 solar masses from Lyman alpha observations. Okay, so this is just to orient ourselves. So, we'll be talking about, earlier times, but, this is just orienting ourselves. Notice the scale here. We're talking about when this discreteness becomes important is on scales of kiloparsecs or so, okay? So that's where we start to see the effect that primary black holes are not like other types of cold dark matter. Okay, so that's one motivation for studying primordial black holes.
Derek, just to make sure that I'm understanding this plot correctly, we should only be looking at the rise at k of 10 to the 3. We shouldn't look at like the suppression at lower k when talking about primordial black holes.
Yeah. This is a cartoon where I just sort of put one line on. Really, you probably shouldn't mix warm dark matter and primordial black holes. Yeah, it's a cartoon.
Okay.
Not meant to be too physical. Just the point is that it turns up, right? So if it was just primordial black holes, it'd be more like one and then turns up.
And then rise. Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a cartoon to illustrate, not something too physical. Okay. So that's why we want to. Okay, primary black holes, they're typical dark matter. Let's see, why is this not going to the next screen? Okay, now it is. Okay, so of course, then we can also say, well, maybe primary black holes are LIGO detective. So maybe this is. I guess we all know this, but let's just walk through the logic. LIGO detected binary black hole mergers, and then they had tens of solar masses. So we're going to be interested in primary black holes that have tens of solar masses. And then, a few weeks later, there's a question, well, did LIGO actually detect dark matter? So as we just saw, primary black holes are dark matter. So maybe if these binary black holes were primordial, then it's also the dark matter. So in this paper, there was the consideration that the way these binaries were considered to form in this paper was, okay, dark matter could be composed of primordial black holes. In high density regions, you could have primordial black holes that come near each other and form binaries, and then these binaries could merge. So what does that look like in a picture? Well, here's what we think the large scale structure of the universe looks like. So this is, a more typical simulation that's like a gigaparsec. And it's what the universe looks like on large scales, as we discussed. And you have all these objects in here that are the halos that are forming. So this is like a filament. So if you look where my cursor is, this is like a filament and it has halos. And in one of these halos, it's composed of primordial black holes. The primordial black holes form binaries and they would merge. So it's nice. It's a nice picture. And so that's why I said primordial black holes can solve some of these large scale problems, like what's dark matter, what black holes make up the LIGO detections. But what I'm going to talk about today is the fact that they start to create small scale problems as well. And that will then constrain their abundance. So in particular, whether primary black holes are consistent with LIGO and whether they're consistent with the CMB, or what I'll be talking about today. Okay, so let's look at constraints, okay? And I'll come back to this plot a few times during my talk, but let's talk about it right now. So this is showing some constraints on solar mass primordial black holes, or solar mass or heavier primordial black holes. And in particular, it's not showing all of them because there's many constraints here. It's just showing ones that are sort of the strongest at a given mass point, okay? So anything sort of weaker than this just is omitted for clarity. But if you like, just to give some context, sort of on the lower end of this mass range, you would have things like microlensing constraints that would be sitting in here. And if on the higher range, you would also have these things like disruptions of different systems like binaries or star clusters. So those are the ones that are sort of sitting around in, but not shown for clarity. Okay, so there's two constraints shown on here that I'm going to be talking about today. So there's these LIGO constraints in green on primordial black hole abundance, and then there's the CMB constraints in red. So let's start with the LIGO constraints. So where did these come from? They don't come from necessarily this picture that I was talking about before. That could be important, but largely they come from a different formation of binaries. And that's the fact that, you know, the way primordial black holes form, their initial distribution when they are created very early on in the universe, sometimes some of them will form close together and they'll form binaries that way, okay? And that's curious. And so, you know, they form close together, and even during the radiation era of the universe, they will be close enough and they will form binaries that way. And it turns out there would be a lot of these binaries if they made up all of the dark matter. So if you have this formation perspective, well, really LIGO should have seen a lot more events than it did, okay? If they were to make up all the dark matter. So that tells you that they can't make up all the dark matter, and that's where these constraints come from. But of course, there's a caveat here, right? And that is that, you know, these binaries could form in the early universe, and, you know, given their initial orbital parameters, they'd be merging today. But do they stay in these nice orbits where they merge today, or are they disrupted by structure formation as time goes on? And do things change that way? So that's one of the things we're going to investigate today. And then also we'll talk about CMB constraints, which are also sort of the very important constraints for this mass range. And so here, where does this come from? Well, this comes a bit later. So something more like after recombination, so like redshift of 1,000. So essentially what's the idea here? Well, primary black holes essentially will start accreting some of the baryons, and then they will then inject energy back into the CMB, and that's something that could be observed. So this is where these constraints come from. And I'll explain, I'll go through the details of this as well. Okay, so this is what I mean, is that we've started by postulating primary black holes as dark matter and all the LIGO events, we've started creating problems for us. And now we have some restrictions on how much of the black hole, how much of the dark matter they can make up. Okay, So what we need is to understand primary black hole dynamics on very small scales. Again, kiloparsecs is what we're thinking for solar masses, and at very early redshifts, again, redshift 100 or above, okay? And so that's what I'll walk you through now. Okay, so of course, we want to understand what are primary black holes doing. We want to understand their dynamics and how they interact with each other. So that means we're going to be running small scale structure simulations, okay? So n-body simulations. So let me tell you about how these are set up, and I'll sort of emphasize how they differ from regular cosmological simulations. So these are all cosmological simulations, but the mood is different in them. So first of all, what do we need to consider? What needs to go into our simulations of these cosmologies? Okay, obviously we want to consider primordial black holes because that's what we're talking about. So we'll say dark matter, it's composed of some amount of primordial black holes, so they make up some fraction of it. This is this abundance parameter, FPBH, and they'll have some mass. And for this talk, I'm just going to focus on the case where their mass distribution is just a delta function, they all have the same mass, just makes things simpler. Okay. Now, of course, if they don't make up all the dark matter, there's the question of what makes up the rest of the dark matter. And that's open, right? It could be a lot of things, actually. So, you know, if you want it to be fuzzy dark matter, it could be fuzzy dark matter. If you want it to be warm dark matter, why not, right? So for the purposes of this talk, when primary black holes aren't all of the dark matter, I'm going to assume there's some sort of generic particle type dark matter. So some generic cold particle type dark matter. It turns out this particle dark matter can't be WIMPs, it can't annihilate, and I'll explain why that comes from on a subsequent slide, but you know, just some sort of inert cold particle will make up the rest of the dark matter, and it makes up the rest. Now, there's some other things that are, the other types of energy in our universe. So we have neutrinos and photons, which are sort of, you know, if we're running simulations in the radiation era, the most important things. But again, we're talking about very small scales, so the actual perturbations of the neutrinos and photons aren't going to be important to us. And really, all we have to consider for these two components is their impact on the background evolution of the universe. Okay. Now, baryons, on the other hand, are more open to what could be going on, right? So until recombination, they're coupled to the CMB. So down to something like recombination, we don't think that anything too important is happening. But after that, when they decouple from the CMB, then they can start clustering. And so that's important. But for this talk, for most of this talk, I'm not going to be considering it. And if I have time at the end, I'll come back and discuss it in more detail, the baryon clustering. So for now, we'll just put them in the background. So, you know, that's sort of an error of omega B over omega M. So something smallish, but not tiny.
Okay. Derek, do you mind if I interrupt with a question?
Of course.
So I have a question about the fraction of primordial black holes. So what I'm trying to understand is, so suppose you start all the way back to inflation and you have your, you know, vanilla slow roll inflation with a spectrum of primordial fluctuations.
Yes.
Is it a matter of prediction then how many black holes you will get, primordial black holes you will get out of those initial fluctuations?
It's somewhat predicted. There is some ambiguity on, you know, things like how large an initial fluctuation you need in order for it to actually collapse into the primordial black hole. But the qualitative picture is sort of known. And so, you know, given the sort of standard scenario where you have some large perturbation that just collapses straight into a primordial black hole once it crosses the horizon, then it's somewhat well understood, with this caveat of the actual size and some of the sound.
Right, speed. So there's a numerical factor that you need to put in to decide when a black hole actually forms. But so then my question is, so for, you know, generic models of inflation, nothing too extreme, is that fraction interesting or is it too small? Is it way too small for, so do you need to go way beyond the sort of standard vanilla model of inflation to get enough primordial black holes to be interesting for astrophysics?
So you need a large power spectrum, okay? And that's somewhat just by choice, I think. Like if you want that, it's not impossible to have, right?
Okay, but that's beyond the sort of scale three model that typically would be given by inflation. Okay.
So you have to assume there's some very fast running, people often put in a delta spike or something like that just to make things simpler. But yeah, you need the power spectrum to take off.
Okay, so bottom line is if you want them, you have to put them in.
Yeah, you have to put it in. It's not something that's consistent with, you know, our measurements of there's not too much running of the running of the power spectrum. And then there's also, of course, this is just sort of the simplest case, of course. If you have non-Gaussianity, you can really start to play with things. Or strong non-Gaussianity. So there's ways where this picture isn't, you know, if you want to make things more complicated, you can make things a lot more complicated, of course.
Yeah, of course. Okay, no, that was helpful. Thank you.
Okay, no problem. Okay, so we've worked through what we need to put into our simulations, and
Sorry, Derek, to interrupt. I think actually one issue, which is maybe might be a little bit ignored. I think I kind of agree with what you're saying, but there is one part of inflation which is completely basically blank, which is the reheating part. And there is really no vanilla model of reheating because there is no model of reheating, basically. I mean, people just kind of make things up, but we don't really have any model. And in principle, weird things could happen then. I'm not sure whether that's, it would be ad hoc to assume that primordial black holes may form. But yeah, I mean, that's one place. I mean, the rest I think is vanilla models don't do it, but in the reheating part, I don't know. But right. There is no vanilla model, I would say here.
Yeah, that could be the case. All right. So I will talk about the initial conditions we set. So where were we? So we talked about what's going into the simulations. So I won't be talking too much about formation, but I will talk a little bit about the initial conditions that we set. So first, let's talk about timescales. So I've sort of been hinting that we're doing everything very early on in the universe, but let's quantify that a little bit. So essentially, let's think about how do we normally set initial conditions for cosmological simulations? Well, what we would want to do is, you know, we go back to some early time where things look linear and we can, you know, set initial conditions that are linear, and that's really nice and easy. And then we let them evolve into, you know, nonlinear structures. That's harder to do with primordial black hole cosmologies on these scales because, you know, if you think about it, like a primordial black hole is never really a linear structure. At some distance to it, there's always going to be sort of things falling into it. So to get around that, instead of starting things when things are linear, because that doesn't make sense, what we want to do is start things early on enough in the universe's history that there hasn't really been time for any important dynamics to have occurred. Okay. So this might be a slide more for cosmologists in the audience, but essentially, if we want to think about this, this is the Mizaros equation. For the growth of linear density perturbations. For both the matter and radiation era. So that's what it takes into account via this sort of S parameter, which is the scale factor divided by the scale factor of matter radiation quality. And it has sort of a growing solution that is one plus something times S, some number that's sort of order one times this, the scale factor divided by the scale factor of matter radiation quality. So what this is saying is that if we don't want much growth to have occurred, well then, you know, we better start our simulations much before matter radiation quality. And so in practice, we've been setting this to be at around redshift a million. Okay, and then so first, then next, what, so when do we end our simulations? This is more of a practical concern than anything else. Essentially, because we're simulating such small volumes, essentially that whole volume is somewhat becoming nonlinear. The universe would be forming halos that are bigger than that have more mass than the volume we're simulating. So there's sort of that would be inconsistent to keep running our simulation. So we sort of stop qualitatively before that occurs, and that's something like redshift 100. So this is why we're sort of running these simulations at these redshifts. Okay, now what are the initial conditions? So what do we put into the simulations? So of course, there are sort of regular perturbations. These are these sort of standard Gaussian perturbations at sometimes called adiabatic. We can include those. But there's a second thing that we have to consider, which is the fact that the way primordial black holes are distributed on small scales doesn't necessarily follow these large scale adiabatic perturbations. And instead, they sort of, if you zoom in on them, it sort of looks like they're just in random locations. So they have Poisson fluctuations, or sometimes you could call them isocurvature. And these are sort of the more important ones for the scales that we're interested in. So obviously on large enough scales, you know, the universe has to look like the universe looks today. So you have to have these adiabatic perturbations, but on the small scales we're considering, these Poisson fluctuations are the more dominant ones. So just in equations, if we wanted to write out density fields, we would have this initial density field, so where the black holes are just randomly formed. So, you know, we just generate a random realization. And then there's additional perturbations. There's the fact that we have these Gaussian perturbations taken into account by, you know, a regular transfer function to get the universe. And also there's the correction for the fact that, you know, we're starting our simulations at redshift a million, not redshift infinity. So there is some time for primary black holes to move towards each other, if you like. So this is taken into account at the linear level anyways. But again, we want this term to be as small as possible, so we start at redshift a million. Okay, so those are the initial conditions. What are the equations that we're solving? They're those, okay, this slide is just sort of, okay, we solve, you know, regular equations of motion for n-body systems. There's a Poisson equation for in the expanding universe. Let me mention for Hubble, of course, we don't really care about dark energy at these redshifts, so lambda is not too important. But we do care a lot about the radiation density. So, you know, you have to add that in. It's not necessarily standard in cosmological codes. And I want, I put this point at the bottom, just because it's a bit technical, but there's a question of what do you do about gravitational softening, right? So we're running n-body simulations. So how much do you soften gravity or not, your gravitational force or not? So softening just means below some scale, do you sort of remove the gravitational, below some length scale, do you sort of remove the gravitational force between n-body particles? So why would you do this? Well, for the particle dark matter, it makes sense, right? You're trying to model something that's actually continuous with a bunch of discrete particles. And so then you don't want strong effects between particles at all, right? Because they're not real particles. They're some macro particle, if you like. So then you soften and you get rid of any sort of strong two particle effects. This isn't the case for primary black holes, right? So for primary black holes, in principle, you want those strong force interactions. And so you would want to consider this. But you quickly run into sort of a practical thing, which is it's sort of challenging to simulate the primordial. It's sort of you, okay, so it's, if you want to run to later and later times, it becomes more and more computationally intensive. So there's sort of been a couple of approaches for dealing with this. So some people have run simulations where they just sort of consider like one halo essentially, and you might put a binary inside it and see what happens, and you don't have any softening and you follow this down to say redshift 1000. Or what I'm going to be talking about today and how we've treated is to not worry as much about the internal structure of halos, or, well, we do worry about the internal structure. I don't point out where we do, but like, we don't worry too much about these strong force effects, but instead just try to get the bigger picture understanding of how hierarchical clustering is occurring in these in these sorts of scenarios. So how big the halos can form and those sorts of things. And there's some argument that this is, or, and why we think we can get the big picture, right? You might be wondering about things like, if you form some halo that's made up of 1000 primary black holes, shouldn't it just evaporate like the globular cluster might evaporate? It turns out the timescales for that are sort of much longer than the how long it takes halos to grow. Halos are growing by merging with other halos in higher clustering. So that process is faster than the evaporation timescale. So that's not too big of a concern. But just something to keep in mind that, you know, there are some things that we can't capture, but you have to keep it. But you should think about. Okay, so this is the equations we're solving. Now, n-body particles, I just want to make a brief distinction just to orient ourselves. So if we make, so we have our simulation, we're running an n-body simulation, as primary black holes, as particle dark matter. The primordial black holes in the simulation are sort of somewhat unique in that the mass of the particles is actually the primary black hole mass we want to consider, okay? So like if we want a 30 solar mass black hole, we make the n-body particle 30 solar masses. This is sort of in contrast with how we set up the particle dark matter, which is, you know, you throw as many particles as you can into it, and they have some mass just based on, you know, their density. But it's not like a physical thing. It doesn't correspond to like the Wimp mass or anything. Of course, it's much, 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 much heavier. And it's just sort of more like a numerical thing, because these are not real particles. They're, you know, numerical particles, whereas these more or less are real particles. Okay, so just a distinction. And in order to ensure that we're sort of modeling sort of how this particle dark matter is, you know, moving around primordial black holes, we really want this condition to be true, that the particle dark matter mass is much, much less than the primordial black hole mass. Okay. So just last slide without a plot, just to give you the actual numbers we ended up using. So here's how we set up the primordial black holes. They're the number in our simulation, so is related to their abundance, is just proportional to their abundance. They're actually just randomly distributed in the simulation volume. So that gives you this physical Poisson noise. The particle dark matter is placed on a lattice, so you don't have any artificial Poisson noise from there. And one nice thing about just simulating dark matter is, of course, there's no real scale involved, gravity being scale free here. And so our simulations are actually invariant to the primordial black hole mass. They, of course, do depend on the ratio of the mass between the primordial black hole mass and the particle dark matter mass, but they're invariant to the overall mass scale. But if you want to orient yourselves into like LIGO mass primordial black holes, we would want the length scale to be like the volume we simulate to be 30 kiloparsecs, whereas the mass would be, and that would give you a primordial black hole mass of 20 solar masses in our simulation with this abundance and with the number of primordial black holes set by the abundance in this way. And then the particle dark matter is much less than 20 solar masses. So that's good. All right. So a lot of slides with some text. So let's watch some videos. Quickly, did they pop up on the screen or are you still looking at my slides? Is it showing?
Yeah, it's good.
Okay, great. All right, so I have two videos to show you. So the first is the simulation where the abundance is, where the primordial black holes make up 10% of the dark matter. So let me play that for you. You can see the redshifts in the top corner. And so not much happens until you get down to redshift of 1,000, and then things start to grow. So let me play that one more time. So again, not much is happening. Then we get to matter radiation quality, and all of a sudden, you know, you start to see all these halos and interesting filament structures that were on the very first slide start to form. Okay, I have a second video. So this is the more interesting case maybe, where we have the dark matter being all primordial black holes. So there's many more to see. So again, some things happen in radiation era, but not too much. And yeah, you can see all these halos forming. I'll play it one more time. So again, nothing much is happening. Then suddenly lots of things start happening once you get to the matter era of the universe. Big halos are forming, things that sort of look like filaments are forming. Okay. So just some videos. Let me go back to the slides. Okay.
And so you're initializing, you said, with just a pure Poisson, like there's no clustering of these black holes initially, like there's no binary black holes initially, is that right?
There could be things that look like binaries, but we wouldn't solve it because of the softening. It's not pure Poisson. So let me just go back. So we do include the adiabatic, the regular Gaussian perturbations as well. But by far the most important effect is the random Poisson distribution.
Okay. For the like production mechanisms, would you expect there to be like a strong clustering bias for these black holes, you know? Like in the same way that peaks are clustered, you know, I would just imagine, you know, that these black holes, which are forming out of like the very rare density peaks, they'd also be highly clustered.
So in the simplest models, that's not the case. But people do like to talk about this, where you do have more initial clustering than pure Poisson. That's a more complicated case to consider. But people definitely do consider that. So there's many papers on it. It's done to sort of try to avoid some of the, you know, to have more clustering gives you some slightly different dynamics.
Right. And the velocities of these black holes are also initially like zero?
No. So then you have both of the velocities from what you would have in in linear theory at redshift a million, which is not much.
Right.
And then you have a correction. But yeah, if it was redshift zero, if it was redshift infinity, then yeah, it would be going to zero.
Right, I see. But if there had been like binaries primordially that then merged or something, then the kicks from those mergers, I guess, would generate some sort of non-zero velocity, right?
Yeah, there are, that is something you could consider as the kicks. I've been told, okay, I don't know about if there's a paper on this. I've been told people have thought about, I've heard this discussed a little bit before, and I guess, I don't know. I have heard people say, oh, maybe kicks could do something, and then other people say, oh no, they don't, and then that's where it's left. I don't have a reference because I've never found a paper that discusses it, but I have heard that brought up before. So it's definitely like a true statement, but I don't actually have a good answer for you on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, okay. Like
that's a very unsatisfying answer, but I think it's I think it is the only answer I can give you is that I've heard it mentioned before, and then I guess people have thought about it and dismissed it or not dismissed it. So I don't really have an answer for you, but
sure. Okay. No problem.
Sorry. It's a,
So I was just thinking out loud that maybe, I mean, you have Hubble drag and then you have radiation drag if you have like a very fast PBH. So they could just slow things down if it happens early. If it happens late, I guess I don't know.
So in order to form these binaries, you do have to overcome the drag. So these binaries are thought to form in the radiation era. Let's see. There is, as you say, there is this effect of the fact that the radiation could be, like a radiation perturbation could sort of be keeping them apart. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was considered in... sorry, where did I don't think it was written down in either of these papers. Mm-hmm. Has been brought up in like discussions before.
Okay.
I don't think it's significant, but it definitely wasn't in these papers. But yeah, that's a true statement that there's an additional effect from the radiation at that time. Sorry, I skipped ahead. Yeah, so the thing that's more considered is like if the whether the dark matter or the baryons are having an effect. Okay. All right, so we've sort of been looking at pictures and now we'll now quantify what structures are forming. So how do we do this? We could do the traditional cosmology thing and show a power spectrum. I'm not gonna talk too much about this because I don't think it tells you too much of anything, but this dashed line is the linear power spectrum at redshift 100. Every slide I'm gonna show you is more or less at redshift 100 now. And if you add in primordial black holes, then you start to get significantly enhanced power. And I guess the one thing I will remark upon is if you see in this case where PBHs make up all the abundance, you can see that the power spectrum has reached one, which is essentially saying, oh, you know, we should start seeing, you know, structures bigger than the volume we're simulating, so we should have stopped, okay? So that's that point I made earlier about why we stopped at redshift 100, so. Okay. All right, so power spectrum. Now let's talk about things that are going to be more interesting to us. So let's talk about the halo mass function. So if we want to come up with sort of an analytic model of the halo mass function, in cosmology, you typically use something like the Prescher-Schechter mass function. But Prescher-Schechter is for Gaussian statistics, and we're not in a regime where Gaussian statistics are the most important. We're in one where Poisson statistics are the most important. So we have to use a discrete mass function. It turns out this has been calculated by Epstein and the 80s, and then there's a few papers by Ravi Sheth in the 90s. And it has this nice form here. If you take the limit where Poisson statistics look like Gaussian ones, then you do get back to Prescher-Schechter for people who want to calibrate themselves that way. So this delta star parameter then starts to look like a critical density. Wait, how well does this mass function do? So here is comparison to our simulations. So dashed, of course, is the analytics, and then we have our simulation over top. So it actually works very well. Okay, so the halo mass function is actually really well modeled by this discrete mass function. One thing I titled the slide halo mass function, but if you look carefully at the axis, it is not a mass, it's the number of primary black holes in the halo. That's what this mass function is sort of telling you about. So that isn't always the mass of the halo. So it is if primary black holes make up all the dark matter, then it is the mass of the halo, of course. But if they make up just part of it, then, you know, there's also this particle dark matter that's falling into the halos. But it turns out, you know, the halo mass is still reasonably proportional to the number of primary black holes in the halo. Again, by definition, true for all the dark matter being primary black holes, and sort of also by definition true if the primary black holes are quite rare, because then, you know, they're just sitting far apart from one another, and they pull in some of the rest of the dark matter, but don't pull in each other. So then it's also sort of true that these all start to look the same. Okay, so we've talked about how PBHs are distributed into halos, and now we've discussed what the masses of those halos. Now let's talk about the internal structure in the regimes where we can talk reasonably about the internal structure. So the most interesting one is to consider is the case where, well, say there's just one primordial black hole, okay, in the halo that we're interested in. So this is like an isolated PBH, just one that's not near other PBHs. So in this case, there's a nice prediction about what they should have for the mass, for their halo profile. And it's given by this r to the minus 9 quarters self-similar radial infall profile from Berschinger. And we actually do get this in our simulation. So if you look at this this line here, this black line, that is actually pretty, actually really good. It more or less is minus 2.25. On the other hand, if you're in a slightly higher abundances, then you know, so let me backtrack a little bit. So this is a PBH that's sort of away from other primary black holes, so it's isolated. But you know, there could be other primary black holes in the simulation itself, just not in the halo that it's in. Okay, so yeah, so then it steepens a little. Okay, what was I going to say? And so this was first seen in this paper, and let me just make a comment on this. They were specifically focusing on the case where this particle dark matter is WIMPs. And because of that, because of how steep this profile is, they found that essentially WIMPs and PBHs are fairly incompatible, because WIMPs would annihilate at high enough densities, and we would have seen the gamma ray signal from such annihilations. So that's sort of a neat fact. Okay. So if they don't make up all the dark matter, then we have to, so then if we look at bigger halos, then we do not find this power log profile, because you're not in the self-similar solution. Okay. So this example is just when there's 15 primary black holes in the halo. Okay, so we've talked about how black holes are distributed in halos. We've talked about the mass of the halos. We've talked about how the mass is distributed in the halos. What are the consequences of that? So first of all, what's the consequences for gravitational waves? So here I'll talk about some results that are out there. So first of all, a few things. So it doesn't seem like particle dark matter will do too much to disrupt these initial binaries that form. That's one result. So this was simulations in this paper. But there was a suggestion that primordial black holes in halos can disrupt binaries for abundances greater than, say, 10%. So if you look down here at these constraints, what this is saying is that instead of going all the way up to one, this would be more like a little island. And so it'd be like a circle or an oval shaped. So just if your binary falls into a big enough halo, then it could get disrupted by other primary black holes being nearby. But there's sort of a subsequent paper and by DeLuca et al, and they use some of the results from our simulations actually. And they say, well, maybe enough survive. just because, well, some binaries will fall into halos, but not all of them will. And there may just be enough remaining. And so it's maybe still a little bit up in the air, which is the whether this is actually an island or not, but you know, there's some arguments both ways. But what I want to mention and emphasize, of course, is that there are other constraints in this region. So even if LIGO constraints don't rule out the F equals one case, there's many others there that would all have to also go awry. So the one I'll talk about then is in my last few minutes is the CMB.
So can I ask a question here? So how does a primordial black hole binary, let's say, gain angular momentum at the first place, right? Like if the initial velocity is very small, then it should be just a radial inflow to each other. And the orbit should be super eccentric.
Yeah, so it's by some third perturber. So they're not quite, you know, they're nearby and then there's other primordial black, there's other perturbations around. And so it's not quite enough to just fully fall directly into each other.
Okay, so the main perturber are other primordial black holes or it's?
I think so.
Okay.
I would want to double check that fact before, without saying it with too much confidence. I think it's the third one nearby, but it could also be other perturbations as well. I think it's also taking into account the Gaussian fluctuations.
Okay.
But yeah, I should check that and make sure. Okay, so these LIGO constraints, and but there's also other constraints around. So I'll talk about the CMB. I think I only have 2 minutes to talk about the CMB, I think, so I'll talk about it quickly. CMB constraints, where do they come from? And why do they care about PBHs? So again, PBHs, you know, once we get past redshift 1000, the gas can start being accreted by the primordial black holes. And so then they will radiate a little and that energy ejection can be, the CMB is sensitive to it. What's the modeling that goes into that? Well, it's using Bondi-Hoyle-Littleton accretion. And so that is saying, okay, the amount, so the energy that gets injected in CMB is proportional to this mass accretion rate, which depends on things like the mass of the black hole and whatever the relative velocities are. There's two relative important velocities to consider. One is the gas sound speed, of course, so how much pressure support the gas has from falling in. Then there's also another effect, which is the relative velocity effect, which is that the gas and the cold dark matter is expected to be moving with respect to one another because of the fact that the gas is initially kinetically coupled to the CMB. And what I want to point out today is that this effect depends on whether a halo is forming around the primordial black hole or not. Okay, so how could so you have a primordial black hole and say, how can these halos that we just talked about, how can they have any effect? So the first thing we could say is, well, what about this velocity? So we talked about the relative velocity, we talked about the sound speed. Maybe there's another important velocity scale, and that could be like a virial velocity in these halos, if you like. So what I show here is the case for, is the sort of velocity dispersion of primordial black holes in halos. And you can see that compared to the relative velocity, this blue line, and the sound speed, this yellow line, you know, these velocity dispersions aren't too important. Or aren't comparatively important. And especially they're not too relevant at these higher redshifts that the CMB is most sensitive to. So over here. So this doesn't seem to be too large of an effect. Okay. And the second thing that could be played with, well, maybe it's not the primordial black hole that's doing most of the accreting. Maybe it's the fact that there's this halo around it. And that could be helping pull more gas in that can then be accreted by the primordial black hole at the center of the halo. So this is most relevant for the case where the abundance is much, much less than one. That was this power law profile that we saw. And so here I'm plotting the gravitational potential as a function of radius distance from the primordial black hole. So this is like a 1/r line here. That would be the primordial black hole gravitational potential. This is the halo potential, this black line, this solid line. And essentially, to think about this, these solid lines are showing these surf sound speed quantities. So if you like this dashed line here, where it intersects the 1/r line, that's the Bondi radius for this Bondi accretion. What you can see is that if you take into account the fact that there's this halo, well, the relevant Bondi radius is sort of like an order of magnitude larger. Okay. So what effect does this have on the constraints if you take into account the fact that you should be able to pull in a lot more gas? It turns out this becomes fairly significant, right? So the constraints can improve by an order of magnitude. So that's what I'm showing here. So the solid, the darker red color is constraints where you don't include halos formation at all. And the pink color is when you do include the fact that there's halo, when you do include the fact that there's this halo that can form. And so on the left is showing the case where you assume spherical accretion. You can think of that as just being slightly more conservative assumption just because you get slightly more weaker constraints. And the right is showing if you assume disk accretion onto the PBH. And if you like, okay, so they do improve the constraints, but of course you're adding an additional assumption about what the rest of the dark matter is. But at least for collisionless models, you know, this cold dark matter case is fairly strong clustering. So, you know, if you had something like warm dark matter, it would have to lie in between these two curves. Okay, so that's sort of a quick version of the CMB. I will not talk about supermassive black holes because I think I'm a bit over time. So let me just show my conclusions. So again, permanent black holes significantly change the structure for formation history of the universe. We talked about the different cases, how the structures that form depend on the abundance of PBHs. Something to emphasize is that the CMB constraints are very strong, and you know that you have to consider the fact that for a lot of masses, you can only have like one part in 10 to the 8 PBH abundance. And the next improvement is including baryons directly in the simulations. So this is something we're actually working on. And so I don't have time to talk about it today, but if you're interested, feel free to ask me about it at some point. Send me an email or something. Okay. So thank you for listening.
Great. Thank you for the very nice talk. Any questions? Well, maybe.
Yes. So for the module of binary primordial black holes, so are they all from the primordial binaries, or they can form into a cluster first, and then somehow become captured to each other?
So in practice, it would be both. Okay, so let me just go back to the constraints. In practice, you would have both. So you would have some that form initially, some that form later on some that form with this other scenario where you know, they form in these halos at late times. So both would occur, but this constraint is mostly from the primordial ones because that's expected to be stronger. But again, they have to survive all the way down to today, which is an additional assumption.
Okay, so if the primordial black holes form a cluster, what's the typical size?
So we can look at that. That, of course, that'll depend on things like the actual mass, but for these, for example, this is showing this 15 primordial black hole halo. And you can see that it's, you know, not even a kiloparsec necessarily.
It's quite okay. Small. Okay. Thank you.
But it's much more diffuse than a binary is, right? They're not strongly impacted.
Any other questions?
So thanks, Derek. Very interesting. I guess that the issue that Neil Lalar brought up earlier, I guess it's just it sticks in my mind that if you do have these very strong clustering early on, then, I mean, wouldn't that change a lot of this story? And you said that people have talked about that, but haven't really included that in any calculation?
So this was Neil's question about the recoil velocities.
Well, I mean, recoil velocity would be, I guess, an outcome if you do have mergers and then recoils. But I mean, just generally having a strong clustering early on when you form this, basically not just randomly distributed, but just in close pairs. So what about that?
So this is if the initial conditions are more clustered than these Poisson ones.
Yeah.
I mean, then you have more clustering and you might expect, you know, more strong effects. But then also if you tend to form in clusters, then it'll be not, you might not necessarily form the binaries that would merge today, right? Necessarily, you might tend to form ones that are, you may tend to form ones that would sit around longer, for instance. And mm-hmm. It's not necessarily super clear that just because there's more close together that you necessarily have a larger LIGO signal.
Yeah, no, I mean, the LIGO signal is, I guess, much farther down the line. Yeah, I don't think, that's not what I was suggesting. I just think this evolution would be more complicated. I guess then since you are doing these simulations, I mean, that's something you could explore, although I'm not sure exactly how you want to explore that. But I mean, you could have started with close binaries early on, right? At least things that are closer than Poisson.
Yes, you can put more clustering in the Poisson. Mm-hmm. There's a question, you want to have a motivation to do it. So people definitely talk about it from a theoretical perspective. It hasn't been done from a numerical perspective. Somewhat it doesn't, how do I say this? If you're down in this region where the abundance is really low, I'm not sure how necessarily relevant it can be. I don't think you'd consider highly clustered models necessarily in this case. The other thing you can start to consider is adding in different mass functions, which also can have a non-Poissonian effect, because even if you say the number density is Poisson distributed, if there's a mass distribution, that doesn't necessarily have to be. You can have differential clustering based on, some PBHs are more heavy than others. There's definitely ways you can complicate the picture, for sure.
Yeah, it's actually, it's a bit unfortunate because there are so many possibilities, but I don't think there is necessarily a strong motivation for any of them, or just having PBHs themselves. It's a bit hard to know what is the most interesting direction to go, but it's just a comment.
Yeah, I think, so that's more or less why we stuck with this sort of simple picture, is that it's very...
Mm-hmm.
Generic and easy to understand, and you don't have to add complications like, you know, weird non-Gaussianities and stuff like that in order to add in additional clustering and stuff like that.
Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, of course. Nice to see you again. Yeah,
that's good to see you.
Any other questions? So you mentioned this green line is just computed using primordial black hole binaries, not those ones formed in clusters. So you're saying that those ones formed in clusters are subdominant. Somehow they give rise to less merger rate or something like that? Yeah.
These primordial ones are sort of much more substantial.
Okay. Yeah, well, recently there are some papers claiming they find primordial black holes in this current LIGO catalog by this population study. Somehow they have have some model for the mass distribution of primordial black holes, and then they use that to do model selection, and they find that, say, 30% of all LIGO black holes are primordials.
That's right. There's this claim that there's evidence in the LIGO mass function itself for primordial black holes. This depends a little bit on if you include the merger from the mass gap or not. So if you, which is the one that's sort of, you know, 100, much heavier, so 100-ish solar masses. That one is, so if you include it, of course, then these sort of like stellar cluster models have trouble explaining it. So then, okay, if you only make your model be, okay, stellar clusters and primordial black, stellar clusters and regular astrophysical black holes plus primordial black holes, and you've, then you sort of have to put in primordial black holes to explain that one event. They do say that if you exclude that very heavy merger, then there's still some evidence, but it's sort of less. So, but even that primordial, even that case where you're sort of in this nearly, not, it's not quite 100 solar masses, but nearly there, that's sort of barely consistent with the CMB, right? So even in that case, they wanted some amount of accretion onto these primary black holes. So they would start over here when they form and get heavier through accretion. And so you could sort of evade these CMB constraints because it's borderline excluded, right?
Yeah. Okay. So if no more questions, let's thank Derek again for this very nice talk.